Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's August 4th. 54 degrees here in Old Town Park City and smoky. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. We continue to see that wildfire smoke from out west continue to move into our area today. We have a westerly flow to our atmosphere and wind. So again, patchy smoke is expected today. We'll see a high of 82. And behind all of that smoke, we have plenty of sunshine, just unfortunately, the smoke kind of shadows it a bit. Patchy smoke continues into tonight, where we expect to see a low of 59. Thursday, we continue with some more patchy smoke and haze hanging over us. We'll see a high of 86. Again, clear conditions, not going to see much in the way of rain. Thursday night, we continue to see some of the smoke linger, but there is the making of some cloud cover for us for a partly cloudy sky. Can range between partly cloudy and mostly clear, and we'll see a low of 59. By Friday, we have the cold front moving through that'll help clear out the air, and we'll also see our temperatures drop. So one thing that we can expect with that is temperatures around the mid-70s, around 76 degrees for us, and again, sunshine with less smoke. Going into Friday night, mostly clear with a low of 53. As we go into Saturday, we expect to see highs still remain around the 70s, 78 degrees to be exact, and sunny skies, mostly clear for Saturday night with a low of 56. Sunday, we continue to increase our temperature slowly but surely as we continue to see sunny conditions with a high of 82. Mostly clear skies on Sunday night as we continue with that calm and dry weather pattern, we'll see a low of 58. Monday, we continue to expect to see sunny conditions once again, 82 degrees. Degrees will be our high, as again we have plenty of high pressure still holding place for us. And then Monday night we'll see mostly clear skies with a low around 57. Tuesday we're expecting to see the possibility of some slight chance thunderstorms and shower activities, but in the morning time it'll be mostly sunny. We'll see a high of 81. Again, this is just going to be some monsoonal moisture making its way back in, but not enough to really create widespread storms. Again, the main factor that we want to focus on is that cold front Friday that'll help cool us down and clear out the skies. From the Pinpoint Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Over to you, Leslie.
Thanks, Cesar. It's 8:08. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be talking with the Vice Presidents of Development for Excel Utah, Kurt Krieg and Brooke Hans, with an update on the Mayflower Mountain Resort. Park City Institute Executive Director Ari Ioannidis and co-founder of the Park City Chamber Music Society, Leslie Harlow, with details on the chamber music series that's starting at the Eccles Center this Sunday. Then an update from the Summit Community Gardens Executive Director Sloan Johnson.
This is Randy Barton with The Local View. It is on the air here at KPCW, 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. Why wouldn't you listen? We give you everything you need. Great music. Oh, our playlist, so expansive and marvelous. Proud of it. Fabulous local news and information. You can delight others with your knowledge of local items, affairs, and events. Keep you up to date on the weather, on fires, traffic, everything about pandemic living here in a mountain town. Tune in.
And stay tuned. Coming up on The Mountain Life this morning, right after the local news hour, today's guests are Mary Ruth Guyam, a certified health educator, nutritional consultant, and culinary chef. She will be talking about her new book, Liquids to Lunch, 11 Other Practical Actions to Move Forward Each Day. Then Jessamine Stanley, an internationally acclaimed voice in wellness, offers her insights on 21st century yoga and intersectional identity. Her new book is called Yoke, My Yoga of Self-Acceptance. All of that coming up on today's edition of The Mountain Life at 9:06. Well, as COVID-19 continues its surge in Utah this week, with more than 82% of statewide ICU beds now in use, hospital workers are expressing frustration with low vaccination rates among the people getting sick. KPCW's Sean Higgins reports.
The Utah Department of Health announced 728 new statewide COVID-19 infections Tuesday, bringing the state's rolling seven-day average of new cases to 877 per day, its highest rate since February 15th. National data shows the current surge in cases can be linked to the highly contagious Delta variant of the virus combined with low vaccination rates. According to the health department, 65% of eligible Utahns have received at least one dose of the vaccine. Anyone 12 and older can get a shot. Summit County is now averaging just over 6 new cases a day. The health department reports 88% of eligible people in the county have received at least one dose of the vaccine. Wasatch County reported 7 new cases on Tuesday and is now averaging just over 11 cases per day. Summit County Deputy Health Director Phil Bondurant said at this week's County Board of Health meeting that the county's current vaccine numbers and case rates do not warrant a new mask mandate. In an Intermountain Healthcare press conference Tuesday, ICU critical care technician Katie Marshall said with statewide hospitalizations up by over 100 people since 1 month ago, she and her ICU colleagues are discouraged by the current trends.
We went through our big surge last year and cases kind of started to go down. It kind of felt like we were going to start getting a break from it, and now we're just seeing more and more cases again. So I think we're all feeling a little frustrated, especially where there is a vaccine and many of the patients we're seeing are unvaccinated or aren't wearing masks. And so when there's ways that people in our community can prevent that, I think we're all just feeling a little bit frustrated and overwhelmed and just worried about what the future could bring.
According to state health officials, hospitalizations and deaths have begun to shift toward people in younger age groups who are unvaccinated. Governor Spencer Cox said on Tuesday that of the 15 statewide deaths reported over the weekend, 7 were under the age of 65 and 3 were between the ages of 25 and 44. 5 more deaths were reported on Tuesday, and 2 of those people were in the 45 to 64 age bracket.
65 and under is far too young to die from something that is almost completely preventable. I'm a person who believes in responsibility. I'm a person who believes in consequences. And if you choose not to get the vaccine, then those are the consequences that may happen. And we have to be willing to live with those consequences. And so again, just encourage everyone to please get the vaccine.
Cox also expressed frustration with vaccine misinformation and added that if people were listening to him and health experts, they would already have their shot. Intermountain Healthcare Medical Director of Infectious Diseases Dr. Todd Vento said on Tuesday that vaccines and masking, when done separately, will not be enough to defeat the virus. He said they must be used together.
Anyone who talks about vaccines are better than masks or masks are better than vaccine, they're missing the point. We have a toolbox of a bunch of tools. Let's use every single tool in that toolbox. I really think it's critical that people not forget about the measures that work. We don't want to wish our way out of this or hope our way to the finish line. We want to do the things, do the work that gets us to the finish line, and then we can actually celebrate, be proud, think of what we did together. We have a common enemy. That's the only enemy we need to fight, the virus. And we know how to do that with every tool in our toolbox.
Healthcare professionals continue to urge unvaccinated people to speak with their doctors about any concerns they might have about the vaccine. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
8:15 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, if you've driven along US 40 between Park City and Heber City, you've no doubt noticed all of the construction happening there on the west side of the highway. That's the start of the Mayflower Mountain Resort. In the studio to give us an update, I've got Kirk Creek. He serves as a Senior Vice President of Development for Ex-Utah Development, along with Brooke Hontz. She serves as Vice President of Development. Good morning, and thanks for getting here. Thank you.
Good morning.
Let's see. So as we've reported earlier, the groundbreaking for the what's known as the MWR Hotel and Conference Center, it's the Morale, Welfare, and Recreation, I believe. This happened in early June, and I think you were under construction maybe the next day. How's that going?
It's fantastic. The groundbreaking was June 9th, and we celebrated it with our partners at the state as well as the U.S. Air Force. The MWR Hotel, you were correct, is a Morale, Welfare, Recreation Hotel. It's a conference hotel, a little over 642,000 square feet with 387 hotel rooms and 55 private residences. You know, the real benefit for this hotel to the region is there's a military benefit where the individuals receive a discounted rate in perpetuity for the stay at the MWR Hotel. So we actually donated the land to MITA, leased it back, and are building the hotel. We also have another parcel that we will donate to the Air Force, which is in, the deeds are in the hands of MITA to execute. And we're really moving forward to make sure that military benefit for the state is there.
What's that other donated piece of parcel property for?
It's 2 acres just to the south of the village. And really what it does is it ensures that the red maple trade with Park City, it gives the exchange value.
Okay. And you don't know what they've got planned for it then? I mean, it's up to them to develop?
That is correct. It's a parcel that just sits right there alongside a little over 2 acres.
Okay. Well, we often hear from Gary Harder, a member of the MIDA Board of Directors, along with the State Veterans Affair, about how do we make sure that the benefits are accessible to our active military and veterans? I mean, what other than discounted room prices, are there other benefits?
Yeah, so it's in a holistic package that was actually created and came from the Air Force. So we've been working with the Air Force out of San Antonio as well as Washington. And what it is it's not only discounted room, but MIDA is also going forward and getting discounts for the participation of different sports. So they're working with Sky Ridge across the street on benefits on golf and horse. And so when you look at it, it also has a what they call a concierge center. And so there's about 2,000 square feet within the hotel itself that is given to the Air Force to provide a concierge. And I should go back on the discounted rooms, Leslie. It's a really interesting system that they put in place. So it's by rank, and it's for active and retired military. So if you're a private, you pay less than if you were a general. So really, they are catering to, you know, their price points within the military. Brooke, do you want to expand on that?
I could also talk about one of the comments that Gary Harder had regarding benefits for veterans. It includes that our workforce housing and our affordable housing plan will include them in the priority waterfall of potentially being able to rent some of the facilities we have on site that we build. So we don't know if that will be of interest, but those folks will be in the priority highest on the list to be able to receive those benefits.
Okay. So I had not heard that before in terms of the tiered pricing, because I was going to think 20% off a $500 room hotel certainly isn't available to a second lieutenant.
Yeah.
You know, the room prices are quite affordable, honestly.
And actually, it's a fixed rate with a CPI escalator to, you know, work with a partnership. So it actually starts at $143.82 is what the contract is.
Okay. So let's just kind of back down a little bit. But the infrastructure, is that now complete, except for maybe the streets?
So we're making great progress on the infrastructure. The Mayflower Village Drive has all of its water, sewer, and storm drain in and has been paved with curb and gutter, which leads to the MWR Hotel. And then Glencoe Way also is paved all the way up to the five-star hotel site with all its infrastructure in. With that said, we've headed to the south and west up into what we call the village estate lots. And by fall, we'll be able to pave and complete those roads as well. So we did do a bond offering. So we have assessment bonds, and we have about $170 million sitting with U.S. Bank, the trustee down in Salt Lake. We have 2 years to complete the infrastructure and feel confident and strong in the position. We have several excellent contractors on, and we are starting our second water tank. So there's three primary water tanks, and we're on to our second.
Okay. In terms of the bonding there, that the tar bonds are, I think, the second part of the bonding. Hadn't we already approved about $295 million in the first round of bonding?
No, the first bondings was in two tranches. It was 68.5 and 99.8. And then that makes up the assessment bonds. There is a TAR bond, or what's called a tax allocation revenue bond. It is more referenced typically as a TIF bond. And that is in process. The investors will see what's called the preliminary offer memorandum issued next week. And then there's investment tours middle of next week. And what that really is, Leslie, it's, you know, there's tax increment on the project. So basically, from property tax, a portion goes back to the county for essential services. And then a portion comes back to MIDA for, you know, public and infrastructure in case what's called mountain improvements. And a portion of that is the MWR for the public component. And so that is future increment that comes in, and the bonds are a pledge of that increment. So it's a financing tool. And that has been authorized as a maximum of $260 million, 30-year duration. moving forward.
Yeah, we certainly haven't seen anything like that in the Summit Wasatch County area. I mean, you've got a long history of development. Have you worked with anything like that? Financing scheme before?
I have. You know, there's Melrose in California. There is tax increment in Colorado. At this point, with the low interest rates and the 30-year duration, it makes a lot of sense knowing the commitment that Extel has. So part of the TIF bonding is we are committing to two of the hotels, so the MWR hotel and or the skier or five-star hotel, which really brings a critical mass. So there's a construction guarantee that's put into place. That's not only for the public, but also for the investors.
Yeah. So you mentioned, okay, the MWR hotel, the five-star hotel, and a skier hotel. So is that the extent of it?
Those are in the first phase. Those are the central hotels within the village. It really brings great diversity. All of the hotels that we have planned are unique in their nature. So they're not competing with each other. And Brooke, do you want to expand and talk a little bit about the Skier Services Hotel and the amenities within it for the public?
So just real quick, though, so there's four or five that we're talking total?
There's actually seven total that are anticipated, but in the first phase, there's three. So it's the Conference Hotel, the Five-Star Hotel, and the Skier Services Hotel.
Okay, then talk a little bit about the amenities there then.
Sure. The Skier Services Hotel is located at the south end of the ski beach, which is intended to support, like just as you see at most resorts and villages around the world, frankly, to have the types of activities, rentals, retail, restaurants, vibrancy that we don't see a lot in Utah because we don't have really ski villages established. And so that's anticipated to be a cornerstone and provide also hotbeds where people are going to be there all the time and active.
Okay. All right. So we've got then the military hotel. We've got the infrastructure. You're also developing what you said with the village estate lots and then what's known as the Pioche parcel. What's this for?
So the Pioche parcel is just to the north. It sits immediately across from the Jordanelle Gondola, and it has its primary infrastructure in place. So what we did is during the pandemic, we started on some apartments over there. So there's 402 market rate apartments that sit on Pioche. And if you could drive by, you'll see that we're already starting to put walls up. So the podium on three buildings are complete. And the fourth is in process. With that said, there's about 115 residential units on Pioche proper. That's looking at 36 estate lots, 66 townhomes, and 13 cabins. And we just got the subdivision approved yesterday from the MIDA board, and we'll record that plat. Brooke and her team did a nice job, and it's a very thorough design. We have sold that parcel off to a regional and multi-state developer. It's IEG, and we look forward to the partnership and going vertical with them.
Okay. And then you also have the approval of two more subdivision plats. Tell me about these. Simi 1 and 2?
Sure.
There must be something. What does that mean, a Simi?
I believe that's silver in Greek, but we might have to double check that. So, Leslie, those are two subdivision plats that are located right above the skier hotel and the ski beach that I was referencing before. And so they're very close to the future village core. They're beautiful estate lots that you can see, especially if you're on the other side of the Jordanelle and you're looking back towards the west, the ski run above them and the two roads that are cut in to service and develop those lots.
Okay, and again, those have been sold off to another developer?
Those have not. They remain with Extel at this point, but they are approved and platted.
Okay. And then you also have final approval of the Pioche Village Estates. This is different, or is that what you just referenced?
That's what you just referenced.
Okay. What about the workforce housing? When does that come online, and where is that?
Sure. So there are lots of pieces of the workforce housing. We're happy to say that the apartments that are going in that are market rate will have a minimum of 17 units within that project that will be dedicated to affordable and workforce housing. And so that's the initiation of our program. We also will have loans available to people who are looking to get into their first home within a certain distance from the project if they have, you know, meet certain criteria. And then we will have additional housing built on the project site, we estimate, probably further to the south or within the village core.
Okay, because there was some talk about a 100,000 square foot building that was just going to be.
Yeah, so what Brooke's alluding to as part of our master development agreement is we have a tranche phase of workforce housing to ensure that we bring workforce housing on in a timely manner to have a workforce on the site and within the resort itself. But that workforce is very diverse, as you would know. So we have managers all the way down to the kids swinging the chairs on the lifts. So we have broken it into components. The first is, you know, workforce on site, and our initial tranche was within the market rate apartments. And then secondly, we have a loan program that is going through the foundation for really to help those managers and mid-level employees to acquire homes in the region. This was, you know, enacted and well done in Tahoe. So we kind of parceled and took that element. And then the third is more of a dormitory style, and I would say common apartments that will be built on site for really the, what we would see more of the seasonal worker. So those are the three tiers that we're enacting, and they are in the development agreement. There are milestones to make sure we don't get out over our skis, per se, and always ensure that there is housing for the workforce.
All right. Quickly, because a portion of the property is on former mining operations, you had some cleanup to do, and you did what's called a voluntary cleanup. Where are you with that?
Yes, we've made great progress. We're thrilled to say. And if you've been tracking by driving on Highway 40 the past couple of years, a significant portion of what you've seen actually is a cleanup. And so up until we purchased the property and did investigations, there was just guesstimates on how much contamination actually could exist on the site. And unfortunately, through examination, we found that the remnants of mining from the Mayflower Mine and the Star Mine, which were, of course, not, you know, they've been there for some, in some cases, over 100 years, extended further than what you could see on the, you know, from aerial photographs or walking the ground. So at this point, we are pleased to say that at least 90% of the work in the village area is complete related to the Phase 1 VCP, and we're down to our final portion that is very close to where the mine portal used to be. And so we have some capping left to do. We plan on doing that this late summer and fall, but that is, we've really done, gone faster and done honestly better than we thought we could even do with help from the state of Utah, making sure that the voluntary cleanup program is put into place accurately and correctly.
So did you haul it away or did you bury it on site?
So there's feel free to read it. It's a very lengthy document called a WRAP. And that document indicated the various ways and techniques that we had to clean up. The best way to deal with most of the contamination on site was to leave it in place and cap it, but there are some components that didn't meet the standard that we wanted to keep on site, and they will be removed. And so it's a mixture of both, and both ways of mitigating are really actually proven to be safe and the best possible way to deal with these, you know, mostly lead and arsenic.
Okay, so still some confusion about when the resort actually starts operating. Do we know? Do we have a timeline?
It's a great question. So as you're aware, last August we renegotiated a 1982 lease with Deer Valley and Alterra, which allows us direct access into the resort for 199 years. We did provide notice to the resort operator that we plan to erect the lift. It's called Lift 3, which will take you into Sultan's Nose, and from there you can either ski to the Sultan Lift or the Mayflower Lift and take you to the top of Bald. With that said, that was a notice for 12 months, so our intention is to begin next May with the erection of that lift. We do have the base for that lift to grade and fully cleared, and are working on other components related to that. But I think more importantly, the question that we're asked over and over again is, you know, what about future ski and the operator? And we've been working with our partners at Alterra, Rusty Gregory, the chief operator, and a new gentleman named Jared Smith, who's the president, Todd Shallon, and Jeremy here locally have all been good. And I think we're making great progress. So I would think in a couple of months, if we can figure this out, we'll hopefully have a positive announcement on the future ski.
Okay. That lift three, are we talking high-speed quad, six-pack?
It's a six-pack, and it is high-speed and detachable. Brooke, will you talk about its bells and whistles?
Sure. The intention is this is going to be a state-of-the-art beautiful lift that would take you right from the base of the ski beach between the Mayflower existing lift at Deer Valley and the Sultan base. So you'd have the ability to ski to either of those or back down towards the ski beach at Mayflower.
Okay. So again, I mean, are we still talking that the lift opens December 2023?
23-24 ski season is what's the intention.
Okay. And finally, just wanted to ask you, back in April of 2020, Wasatch County had asked for an expansion of the MIDA board and talked about bringing on two new representatives. I mean, I think we were talking like State Senator Ron Winterton and the District 54 representative seat. And you had expressed certainly interest in that, but nothing has happened since then. So is that kind of a dead issue, or is it, has Mike Davis now as MIDA coordinator kind of taken over that role, or?
You know, that's a great question, and the two governmental entities really need to, you know, I wouldn't say work things out, because they've started to communicate in a way that has really been fantastic for the project, and not just our project, for the entire east side as well, with Sky Ridge and, you know, Lee Burbage and the marina parcel. So what they've done since that time is, you know, the DRC, or the Design Review Committee, is really structured to be principally a Wasatch County representative, other than Ray Whitchurch and a couple of others, such as Ryan Stark, who sits on GOED, but Ryan does live within Wasatch County. It is principally filled by Wasatch County employees. And then most recently, as you mentioned, Mike Davis was brought on as really what they call the MIDA liaison. And with that, in partnership, MIDA's helped fund that position, but it really is to make sure that there's solidarity and that Wasatch County, while not directly governing the projects or the project area, continue to have great input. And I really have to say the other element is they formed a PID board. And so Steve Farrell, who is a Wasatch County councilman, not only sits on the MIDA board, but also is the chair of the PID for the project area. And that's very important. And I got to say, Steve's participation and leadership over the last 8 months has been tremendous.
Okay. I got to leave it there, guys. Anything else that you wanted to add, though?
No, many thanks.
All right. Kirk Krieg, Brooke Hans with XTEL Utah. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:35. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:36. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. We've got 55 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. Again, looking for that smoky sunshine through the day and probably part of tomorrow as well before we see some winds come in and blow it out of here. Looking for, again, a high today of 82. Looking for a high in the Heber Valley of 90. Currently, we've got 57 degrees there. Well, the Park City Chamber Music Society and Park City Institute have teamed up and will be presenting chamber music at the Eccles Center for the Performing Arts. Joining me now in the studio, I have one of the co-founders of the Music Society, Leslie Harlow. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay through my mask?
Yeah. Can we pull it off just for now?
Of course.
Yeah, that would be great.
All right. There we go.
Perfect. So can you tell us a little just about the partnership? How did it come about?
Ari contacted us, actually, from the Park City Institute, and we were delighted. And so we got busy and put together a really wonderful series there. We're so excited to play in that hall. We've played there in the past a couple of times, and it has beautiful acoustics, and of course we're excited.
Yeah. I mean, in the past, I mean, you've mostly just been using private homes and maybe City Park, huh?
Oh, not just those. We've been playing at Temple Har Shalom and the Park City Community Church as well with our full series. It's been 36 concerts a year. But we just love to play there again. We used to run a Young Artists Institute, and we performed there. We had full orchestra there in the Eccles, so we know what it's like. I played there with the symphony, too. So
the Eccles, of course, a big theater. The acoustics sound just as well if it's not filled?
Oh, yeah, of course. It really matters more. The backdrop behind us, the audience itself, it doesn't matter so much acoustically for us.
All right, so you're kicking things off Sunday, August 8th, and showtime at 3 p.m.
3 p.m., which I think is a really great time, and especially with the hot weather we've been having, it'll be nice to be in there because it'll be cool. And that first concert that we're doing is actually a concert with film. It's so exciting because it's a special, rare event that we'll be showing The Gold Rush by Charlie Chaplin, the 1925 version, with music of Beethoven, classical music of Beethoven. And Beethoven is such a humanist, everyone will be amazed at how beautifully it augments that film. And this is rare because the Chaplin family usually doesn't give permission for anyone to show this film without the music of Charlie Chaplin. So that's a very special event for us. Go ahead.
How'd you figure out that Beethoven goes with Charlie Chaplin?
Actually, 20 years ago, Russ put this score together, and we presented it live back then in Park City. And when Ari talked to us, we were putting together what we thought would be a really exciting series for the people in Park City and our tourists. And so we decided to start with this film.
Right. So what else have you got lined up?
Oh, we have this wonderful trio of Venezuelan artists who specialize. They do all the standard classical, which is great, but they also specialize in South American composers. And they're doing works by Ponce, and I'm trying to remember everybody off the top of my head, but it's really exciting chamber music, and they're great young players with an incredible amount of energy. They're in Spain right now recording, and they'll be coming here after they leave Spain. All the players live in the United States, but they teach here in the U.S., and they'll be joining us. So we're excited. It's called the Reveron Trio with violinist Simon Goyo, which people have heard him before here with the Dolly Quartet, who's played with us before. They're just beautifully exciting, and we can't wait to present them. And they're on the 20th on Friday at, I think it's at 7 or 7:30. People should go to our website. And then that's at the Eccles. And then on the 22nd, we're doing a concert with our chamber music players who are coming in. We have a violinist from New York, Rebecca Johnson, who's played with us before. She was a child prodigy on the violin. She's phenomenal. A cellist from Belgium who's played with us before, Tom Landschut, is coming in. He's a fantastic cellist. Then we're combining with the trio with Simone and Horacio Contreras, the cellist from the Reveron Trio, also to perform the Schubert Cello Quintet, which is one of the biggest favorites in chamber music. And along with that, we're doing the Mozart Clarinet Quintet, which is one of the other famous and beloved pieces. So we'll be doing those two works on the 22nd, and that will be a Sunday at 3 o'clock. The beautiful thing about the Mozart Quintet, I have to add, which is kind of fun, we were performing it down in Salt Lake for the Hansen Planetarium years ago, and if people saw the film about Stephen Hawking, they saw that he came to the United States. Now, we didn't realize this was his first trip to the United States, but he came to Utah to help open the Hansen Planetarium, the new one. And they had a special event for that, and they asked us to come and play. So we were playing for that event at Lakai and playing the Mozart Quintet. Russ was performing. And Stephen Hawking came out to talk to us with his nurse. And it was amazing for us. I mean, this was pretty early on when not so many people knew about him. And he said through his nurse that the Mozart Quintet is his favorite piece. So we were blown away by that. We were thrilled to, of course, play for him and for that event. So that's an incredible piece. And Russ plays it quite beautifully. We've recorded it, and it's on. We have it on a high-def website for downloads and things like that. So.
And then you have one August 29th as well.
Yes, on August 29th. Now, some people here in Park City, I'm sure, have been going to the Deer Valley Festival, and they heard a fantastic pianist, Stephen Buse, performing Rachmaninoff's second concerto with the symphony last week. Well, Stephen's going to be in concert for our festival and our series on the 29th, and that'll be at 3 o'clock. And he is an amazing pianist, and we've had many, many over the last 38 years. And I know the audience will be so thrilled, and it will be a nice intimate performance, even though it's in a large space. And he'll talk to the audience and talk about the music that he's playing, and his playing is phenomenal.
So you've got four then scheduled at the Echo Center this summer. Any plans for later in fall, winter?
Actually, I'm glad you asked that, because we are already talking about future concerts, and we haven't decided what we're going to do yet, but we have so many resources to be able to put on 10 concerts in the next year. That's what they've talked to us about, and we're just looking at what we can come up with.
Okay. Tickets are $35, available at parkcityinstitute.org.
Right.
And in terms of being able to see the schedule, I guess it's there as well, but what's your website?
Ours is the Beethoven Festival. It's under beethovenfestivalparkcity.org. And we'll have an update on the film on there later today. We don't sell tickets from our website, so it's probably best if they go to the Park City Institute website. Save time, and it has all the information.
Okay. Again, this Sunday, August 8th, 3 p.m., kind of a really unique experience. It's going to be live music of Beethoven, screened with the Gold Rush, a film from 1924, a silent film.
It is considered one of the top 100 films ever made. It is such a classic, and people will love it. It's funny, and the music really goes with it so beautifully. In fact, when we were working on it, we spent many, many hours putting the music together with the film and listening to it all the time, of course. And at that time, for several years, every time I heard Beethoven, I would see Chaplin in my mind, because it's a perfect match.
Great. Leslie, hey, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Leslie Harlow, again, one of the co-founders of the Park City Chamber Music Society. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:46. Good morning. Well, severe weather hit Summit County Sunday, taking out irrigation pumps, depositing debris in yards, and filling garages with mud. Tom Chappell has lived in Wanship along Hoytsville Road for more than four decades. He says Sunday's storm was the worst he's ever seen. In just a few minutes, he says, water rushing down from Bedford Canyon flooded the neighborhood.
We've been here 45 years, and we've had, you know, a little bit of rainwater come down this canyon and go alongside the road. But this is the first time it's ever been up to our driveway, because
Chappell has a lot of debris in his yard, and there were 4 inches of mud left in his garage. Luckily, he said the garage has a back door, which happened to be open, so the water was able to run through. He says that there were a couple of nearby homes, though, that did see some water damage. The heavy rain that came down quickly turned Cottonwood Creek, that flows by Dick Stoner's house and Dog Holler, into a river.
Our stream is typically maybe, you know, 4 feet wide, not very deep. It was 30 feet wide. It was chocolate brown. It was moving rocks. We had a walking bridge that was taken. Our irrigation pump that we use on our garden was completely under a rapid of water, and right below us, of course, is Renewy Gardens. They weren't home. I went down and looked at their irrigation. Was also, their pump was out. Just the electrical system and connected hoses were keeping it from going downriver. And all of this ends up in neighbors' alfalfa fields that they irrigate. And those fields, of course, are completely inundated with rocks, gravel, and mud.
His biggest loss may be the brand new irrigation pump that he had just installed after the old one seized up. He says he'll take it in and see if it can be repaired. He says they see flooding in the stream every year, but it's been a good 20 years since they've had any real flooding. Whitesville Road was covered in mud. Stoner says the farmers took the problem into their own hands and used their tractors and heavy equipment to clear the road.
Basically, it's farmers on their tractors, on heavy equipment, trying to create some, ditching as we continue to get rain. And there's a concern once you have these floods, once you have these cuts and these ravines, the cutting continues.
Summit County Public Works Director Derek Gradke says they also saw some flooding and mud debris that needed to be cleaned up in Chalk Creek. Park City Police spokesman Phil Kirk says they were called out Sunday to assist with traffic control and stop drivers from driving into Big Cottonwood Canyon over Guardsman's Pass after a rock slide in the canyon had closed the road. KPCW News Time now, 8:49. Joining me now in the studio from Summit Community Gardens, Executive Director Sloan Reed. Good morning, Sloan.
Hey, Leslie. How are you?
Good. So it's harvest time?
It's harvest time, yeah. I was just in the garden this morning and harvesting. It's so nice with all this rain. Everything's growing so much more quickly.
Okay. So yeah. You've got a farm stand that, what, you're growing your own vegetables and using some of those from garden members to sell?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have demonstration gardens where we grow our own vegetables. Most of that we donate to families in need, and the excess we sell at our farm stand. And the farm stand is Wednesday morning, so you can go there this morning from 9 to noon. So today you'll find we've got lots of carrots, a bounty of carrots, some tomatoes. We have some squashes coming up. Lettuces, Swiss chard, all sorts of stuff. So,
okay. And that goes through when then?
We'll just keep going until as long as we're producing vegetables, we'll have the farm stand. So usually it's about the beginning of October we stop.
Okay. And then this year you're going to be offering some after school programs. Tell me about those.
Yeah, so we've just set up our after school program for the fall. So this is Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays. Kids can come to the garden after school. It's from 3:30 to 5:30. This is for elementary school kids, and we have garden activities for them. So we do science experiments, we do art in the garden. They get to learn about they get to learn about soil and how to prepare a garden bed for the winter. They get to harvest our veggies and cook food with them. We've got all sorts of fun activities. So, yeah, if you want an activity for your kid after school this fall, go onto our website and sign up for After School in the Garden, and that's up.
They'll need their own transport to get there?
Yes. So you meet at the garden, and then you need to be picked up at the garden as well.
Okay. And who's running that for you? Are you doing it, or...?
Yeah, so we're doing it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. And then coming up, I think you have, a couple of more dinners in the garden, but a big one on August 12th?
Yeah, so August 12th is our family night in the garden. There's still tickets available for that. And we're also looking for volunteers for that as well. So that's going to be a great night. We're going to have music. We're going to have it's sponsored by Devonza's Pizza. And then we have other nonprofits that are going to be there doing activities for kids. So Recycle Utah will be doing a craft. Eats is going to have their smoothie bikes. We've got face painting. We have some other craft activities. Kids will be able to paint terracotta pots and plant seeds. All sorts of fun activities for kids and music for adults to enjoy themselves, and Devonza's Pizza.
Okay. Tickets are how much?
And so it's $25 per person, or you can buy a family of four for $75.
Okay. And again, people can get tickets online?
And they can get tickets online at summitcommunitygardens.org.
Okay. Is that the final one then for the year? Or?
And yeah, that's the final the final dinner that we have tickets for as of now.
Okay. All right. So what's going to happen then this winter? I mean, are you guys just kind of close shop? Or?
Yeah. So we usually spend our winter essentially planning for the summer. So, you know, our season goes on until the end of October. We do, we're going to do Halloween in the garden again this year. And then after that, we start planning for the next year.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Yeah, and we'll also have classes during the winter. I also wanted to bring up a class that's coming up. We have our canning and pickling class, and that'll be Tuesday, August 17th. We still have room in that class. And so that is taught by Linda Elbert, who owns Mindful Cuisine, and that's a really great class. You can bring your own veggies, we'll provide veggies, and you get to do some canning. Last year we canned beets, and then we pickled beans, but whatever you have to bring, you can can and pickle, and she'll teach you how to do it. So that's a lot of fun.
Oh, dilly beans, love them.
Yep.
Okay, Sloan, thanks.
All right, thanks so much, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:54. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, masks will not be required in schools when classes begin later this month. The new Utah law bans schools and the State Board of Education from requiring masks for in-person learning or gathering on school campuses. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more.
School starts soon in the Wasatch Back, and although masks won't be required, schools still plan to contact trace and test to stay, if necessary. North Summit School District Superintendent Jerry Holmes said their priority is to keep children in school and keep everyone safe. He said last year there was a different mentality about masking.
Our folks were so appreciative that we had chosen to do in person, and at that point they were willing to do whatever it took, which meant masking up. But as the year progressed and as the line that has divided us as a country grew wider, more debate took place and everyone believes their side of it, I just don't think there will be as much appreciation this year as much as the demand to be able to be in school with or without masks.
Park City School District Chief Operations Officer Mike Tanner said they'll encourage face masks for everyone returning to school, regardless of their vaccination status. However, under HB 1007, masks can't be required by the school district. He said increased air circulation, additional sanitizing, hand washing breaks, and voluntary COVID screening would be in place when schools open on August 19th. All protocols used last year will remain except for the masking mandate.
All of our schools are under 1,500, and at the 1,500 student level, it takes 30 students positive within 14 given days to close the school. So we'll obviously be collecting those numbers and watching those statistics. And if that happens, we have the option to close the school or keep it open with tests to stay.
Park City High School Student Council President Kelly Loverson said her classmates are happy with the announcement that mask wearing is optional.
It is definitely a controversial and political topic with the mask not being enforced or if they are being enforced. But what I think about is just student council and the administration and the school district. Their best interest is student safety. So if it does get to a point where we do need to be enforcing masks again, then I support that because I think the safety of the students is the most important thing. And then otherwise, if it isn't a matter of safety, I think it's just a personal opinion and personal choice. And I think every student should definitely have like the choice if they do want to wear the mask or not. But I can't assume that most students, because most students are vaccinated, will not be wearing a mask if they have the option not to.
Park City Education Association President Jake Jobe said teachers are most concerned about student safety, especially the little ones getting the virus, because there is still so much unknown about long-term effects.
Teachers' primary concerns are always our students. I think that's the part we're most worried about, is just our ability to keep our kids safe, can you educate them and do both of those things at the same time. I think we did a decent job of it up here last year. It kind of took all the stakeholders to do so, and I think the masks were an important part of that. Obviously, the vaccine, a new tool that's really helpful, but I think the Delta variant does add complexity to that we didn't necessarily anticipate in May that we're now kind of dealing with again.
Utah State Board of Education member Carol Lear represents the Park City School District and is disappointed with the mask ban. She said the State Board of Education has always supported local control, recognizing every community has different needs.
it made it impossible for a school district or a school to mandate the wearing of masks. I can't even see that the High School Activities Association could mandate that for high school activities. It's unfortunate, in my opinion. It gives great lip service to local control, but then the legislature does something like this that makes it impossible for a local governmental entity to make rules for itself.
Lear said the legislature did not consult the Board of Education for input on HB 1007. Summit County Deputy Health Director Phil Bondurant said the law gives local health officials authority to issue mask mandates with the support of the elected body, which is the county council. It applies to school districts, but a mask order would be limited to 30 days, longer if approved by the legislature. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
And meanwhile, the Utah Department of Health is releasing recommendations for kindergarten through 12 schools amid the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The department is recommending that local health departments and schools use what it calls a layered prevention approach, including encouraging vaccination and mask wearing. According to Dr. Michelle Hoffman, deputy director of the department, doing so can help minimize the disruptions of COVID-19 on our schools while maximizing opportunities for children to participate in in-person learning and extracurricular activities. For those in grades K through 12, the Utah Department of Health encouraging everyone 12 years and older to get vaccinated for COVID-19, wear a mask when indoors, isolate at home if you test positive for COVID, quarantine and other protective measures after a school exposure, stay at home, of course, when you're sick, physical distance, improve or increase indoor ventilation. And of course, continue up with those hygiene practices, cleaning and disinfecting. These recommendations were developed after a lot of discussion and input from stakeholders, including local school administrators, local health officers, the Utah Education Association, parents, physicians, elected officials, the state legislature, and the governor's office. Local health departments and local education agencies will work together using this local data to identify which recommended quarantine and protective measures are used to protect the health of students and school staff. Recommendations could be different across the state. Parents and school staff who have questions about how COVID-19 will be handled in their school or at extracurricular activities, including sporting events, should contact their local health department or school for more information. Of course, COVID-19 vaccinations are free and available to anyone 12 years and older. Coming up now on 901, stay tuned for headline news, followed by The Mountain Life. You've been listening to the local news hour here on KPCW Park City, 91.7, 88.1 FM in Summit County, 91.9 FM in Wasatch.